The Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation has released a survey of its members, which really underscores the mental impact upon them of working throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Kilcullen resident Steve Pittman, who's head of education and professional development at that organisation. Steve, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Claire.
90%, the overwhelming majority of your members facing mental exhaustion. I think it's something we can all appreciate why your members are feeling that. I suppose the issue is that it's continuing and there doesn't seem to be any light at the end of the tunnel.
I think that's spot on. I mean, these figures are quite shocking in terms of the levels of exhaustion reported and also the levels of negative psychological impact of COVID-19, because in the survey we conducted of nearly 2,000 nurses and midwives in Ireland, what we found is that 85% reported that COVID had a negative psychological impact upon them. And this survey was conducted between April and July this year. And those figures went up from a similar survey we conducted last year, during the summer of last year. But probably even more surprising is that when asked about whether their colleagues had been impacted negatively psychologically by COVID, the figure is sort of 97%. You know, and it couldn't be much higher than that. So that really underlines the seriousness of this issue.
And the fact that the survey, Steve, was conducted between April and July of this year, it means that, I suppose, the initial boost of energy, that blitz spirit that emerged at the beginning of the pandemic, would have been replaced with a feeling of constantly being on a pandemic treadmill for your members.
Yeah, I think 18 months into the pandemic, it's been unrelenting. We're still in the pandemic and we're also facing into the flu season and also uncertainty around staffing. We can see the recent trolley watch figures from the INMO from yesterday are now the highest figures since the start of the pandemic. So that just underlines sort of the continual pressure that nurses are under. And this is coupled with that during the pandemic, we've seen many nurses were working through breaks, were unable to take annual leave as well. Many of them were going off sick with COVID or for other reasons as well. So all of those factors play into a very high demanding environment where resources and energy is being sapped.
And I would imagine staff shortages, the distinct lack of colleagues on whom to rely and with whom to work in wards and hospitals up and down the country has been a huge factor in your members' experience of that mental exhaustion, in the fact that many of them are considering leaving the profession and, you know, they're on the verge of burnout. We can see one instance highlighted today. Nurses at St Vincent's in Dublin are using baby monitors to keep an eye on critically ill patients because of staff shortages, because there aren't enough of them to be present to monitor staff. That has to be both deeply worrying for your members, but also very distressing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's alarming. It is distressing. And it's an excellent example. Like yourself, I read the article that appeared in the journal. It is something that is being covered by our industrial relations department. But the information provided in the article, yeah, just is a clear case study of the experience of nurses throughout the country, not just within intensive care, but also in other sectors, particularly within the residential care sector, which was hit quite badly, as we know, during the peaks of the pandemic. Just to say as well that the figures of mental exhaustion is the key factor for burnout. So if that is not dealt with, that just spirals out of control in terms of people feeling sort of disassociated with work and sort of leads to sort of personal lack of accomplishment, which again is a trigger for people to leave the profession. Just to say as well that the figures that we actually found, so the question we asked was, have you considered leaving the profession as a result of COVID? And the figures from last year, when we carried out the survey, were 62%. So they've gone up this year. So which means that it is a continuous issue. But it's also worth saying that just because they indicated during the survey they'd considered. Doesn't mean they will.
Yeah.
We did ask a different question as well, which was, do you intend to leave within the next 12 months? And a quarter of respondents replied yes, they are likely or very likely to leave nursing or midwifery in the next 12 months.
And that is deeply worrying, and I would suggest, Steve, that that is really the probative figure, because it means that even should a smaller proportion than 25 follow through on their stated intention of certainly strongly considering leaving the profession, it means that those who remain will be under greater pressure.
Absolutely, and it raises issues around the safety of staff and the safety of patients as well. One of the key demands from the INMO, and we've been advocating and fighting this for a long time, is the full implementation of the safe staffing and skill mix. The Department of Health published a report in 2018 on this issue. We have rolled out three phases of this programme, or the HSC have, around medical and surgical wards, ED departments, and now they're starting work on residential. But they haven't funded it. We need more funding and allocation of resources to fully implement the safe staffing framework throughout the whole of the country in all sectors.
Well, Kilcullen resident Steve Pittman, Head of Education and Professional Development at the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, thank you indeed for your time today. Very distressing scenes at University College Cork last night. The Union of Students in Ireland unit there opened a food bank. Every scrap of food was gone in under 50 minutes. Such is the degree of need there. I'm joined on the line by Vice President of Welfare at the Union of Students in Ireland, Sorla Brennan. Sorla, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Delighted to do so. This is, as I said, a very disturbing situation. Can you outline for us, how long the food bank has been in situ there, and B, what happened last night?
Yes, of course. So the situation happened in UCCSU down in Cork. As far as I'm aware, the UCCSU launched their food bank for the last couple of days due to demand. And then basically last night, after launching, in 50 minutes, they were entirely out of food. They had over 100 students show up to avail of the services, and it got to the point where they eventually had to start turning students away because they just absolutely ran out of food. At the moment, they are appealing for people to be able to donate food and to donate funds so they can kind of keep the service running, as there is such an incredible demand for it. But it is a heartbreaking situation to see.
Particularly the fact that a food bank has had to be set up at all, but also the fact that it was oversubscribed so quickly and people were in a position where they had to turn away fellow students and say, no, we have no more food left for you.
Yes, absolutely. It's genuinely appalling that we are seeing students having to resort this far just to continue living and to continue accessing higher and further education in this country.
Is rent a primary issue? Is the lack of availability perhaps of part-time work a contributory factor? Is the level of SUSI grant also something with which to contend here?
Yeah, absolutely. The entire situation is kind of reflective of the overall problem within higher education that we can see at the moment, where there is a desperate need for our government to start putting further funding into higher education. At the moment, we're calling for and have been calling for a number of years to see publicly funded education put in place. Along with that, like you mentioned, there needs to be a SUSI grant that's reflective of the living wage in Ireland of being a student in this country at the moment. And like you said as well, rents are absolutely going to have an effect on this. Mm-hmm. We are currently in the midst of an outrageous accommodation crisis. We've seen students having to resort to staying in B&Bs, hotels, sleeping on their friends' floors, just so they can continue accessing college, just because rents are either too high to be accessed by a student, or there just isn't accommodation available.
And I suppose we're all used to that cliche that, you know, students are supposed to be quote unquote poor and just eat tins of beans. But in this day and age, that's really not good enough to perpetuate that stereotype in what, in for many people, is a land of effective plenty.
Exactly. As far as I would believe, that stereotype is just incredibly outdated. It shouldn't be a stereotype that students are poor and that students should have to suffer. Nobody should have to suffer just because they want to access further education. It's a stereotype that really shouldn't even be enforced at all at the moment. Mm. Students deserve to be supported. Students deserve to have financial support. They deserve to have academic support, and they deserve to be given every opportunity they can to access education.
I know St. Vincent de Paul has described this situation as really shining a light on the fact that the system providing financial support to students is clearly broken. It says it's reinstated its partnership with the Students' Union today to assist them in meeting demands. I would imagine, Sorla, that's very welcome to have the logistical expertise of St. Vincent de Paul, but you're simply putting a tiny little plaster over a huge crack.
Exactly. Obviously it is incredibly welcome to see the support from St. Vincent de Paul, mm. but the fact that we're in a situation where St. Vincent de Paul have to offer their support at all is really reflective of the wider situation. Like you said, it is putting a plaster over a huge crack that is growing every single day. We need to start supporting our students long-term and putting accessible, affordable plans in place now, rather than the support that our country gives our students being reactive to situations.
And are you aware if there are food banks in any other third level institutions, Sorla?
As of now, I'm not 100% sure where is. I know some places are in the process of considering it. I know others are in the process and are running the likes of hygiene product banks instead, where students can access kind of essential hygiene products that they may need. I know that's operating out of Galway at the moment, but the conversation regarding food banks has been going on for years. I know some institutions have launched them and then had to cease them just because it was no longer required, which is obviously a good thing.
Yeah.
We passed a mandate within our own Congress to support institutions in setting up food banks and supporting them. So this isn't a situation that's come out of nowhere. This is a situation that really has been looming on the horizon and that we all hoped we wouldn't reach, yet now we have.
Sorla Brennan, Vice President of Welfare at the Union of Students in Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Certainly a very stark situation where a food bank at UCC ran out of food in under 50 minutes last night. 13,000 contacts were made with the Rape Crisis Network of Ireland last year, a 22% increase on 2019. To discuss this and indeed its implications, joined on the line by Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network of Ireland, Dr. Cliona Salier. Cliona, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
I suppose, first of all, to enable continued support of survivors of sexual abuse and violence, Cliona, that may want to have accessed your services, you had to pivot very, very quickly after March of 2020.
Oh, absolutely. And what the centres did in that time was extraordinary. They, you know, within a week, the rape crisis centres across Ireland had left the centres and had become remote. And that was staff and volunteers all around, and just like a lot of other people in this country, just converting their homes into their office spaces. But of course, the added complexity for counsellors in rape crisis is that you really need to pay attention to privacy there.
Mm.
So that was a challenge, both for survivors themselves in terms of how they found space to engage with us from their homes, and how we deliver that as well.
I would imagine you had an awful lot of contacts from sheds, from cars, from people out saying, you know, I'm just going to walk for the dog. Because if you're living with the person who is engaging in sexual violence against you in particular, how else can you seek help or support?
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, that's really critical in domestic violence. And about 25% of the adults engaging in these statistics and this report would be people who experienced, probably in the past now, the sexual violence within a domestic violence setting from a partner or ex-partner. But I suppose, like everyone else, in terms of the innovation, I mean, one of the things that you also do to accommodate this is not just the garden shed and what have you, and trying to find that time, but it's also that you're flexible in the hours. So, you know, councillors were working all hours because that was where they managed to find time where they both could find that space.
I would imagine it was also incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to recruit, train and onboard new councillors during the course of certain levels of restrictions in the first year or so of the pandemic, given that you couldn't onboard people to respond to that quite significant increase in contacts.
I think that's one of the things we've emphasised today, and obviously we're only a few days off from the budget, so we're kind of focused on that. But it is, you know, there's a longer story here, and it's not about simply COVID. It's about where we were when COVID hit. How ready were we to respond to a crisis of this nature? And I think it's exemplary how the Rape Crisis Centres did do that, because the situation they were in was we were coming out of 10 years of austerity. Mm. We had barely reached the 2008 levels of funding in 2019 when COVID hit. And we had seen in that period, and one of the things we've done here is we've asked, well, is this, because there's a risk that we treat these figures and these percentages and the increases here as a blip, you know, something exceptional that happened in COVID. But we know we've been having year-on-year increase in demand, and we know that rape crisis centres have been doing their utmost to meet that demand year-on-year and that increased demand. So what actually you're looking at when we came into 2019 was we pared everything back in order to meet demand with no increase in funding, and in fact with cuts, managing cuts, while increasing our service delivery. So we had nothing left in the tank, if you like, in terms of the extra stuff, or the stuff that's often thought of as extra, but it's not extra at all, it's essential stuff. And that is, just as you named at the start there, we hadn't been training anyone. We haven't brought in new staff. We haven't got specialist counsellors out there ready to be recruited because we haven't been able to invest in training. And so that's a bit, so we can't simply, you know, there's a bit where if the lack of funding over a decade has, if you like, pared our infrastructure right down, we can't simply throw money at that and expect it, as you say, to be able to recruit people who don't exist out there.
One of the other key points that was raised as part of the annual report, Cliona, is the fact that almost two-thirds of survivors disclosed that they had been subjected to additional forms of violence occurring at the same time as sexual violence. And that would really, I think, speak to the need for a multifactored or multifaceted response in supporting them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've always in the rape crisis sector always spoken about how sexual violence is it's a crime of violence, not of passion. And so additional violence, and we talk about additional violence, not simply, you know, not violence, because the sexual violence itself is a violence, but the additional pieces of violence, we track that and we record that because there is quite an extensive amount of it. And of course, for different categories of people, that would be different. For people who are experiencing sexual violence from their partners and ex-partners, we're talking about a domestic violence coercive control context, that additional violence is very, very high.
I suppose one thing the pandemic did highlight was that the traditional stereotypical conception of sexual violence taking place in nightclubs, in bars, in pubs, or at events connected and events and locations connected to those kinds of situations is not the norm. It's not the predominant experience of sexual violence by those to whom it's subjected.
It's not the predominant, but I think it's more that what we would say is that, and this data isn't prevalent data. So this data, the story of what happened in COVID in terms of sexual violence that was perpetrated, is yet to be told. Mm. We won't know that yet. But what we can say and what we think is that really, if you think about sexual violence as, you know, it's a crime of opportunity, but it's also a crime of intention. You know, so that. You simply, what we observe over and over and over again is innovation in perpetration, essentially, if I can put it that way. You know, perpetrators find a way. and they find new ways. And of course, one of the explosions in you know sexual violence that we saw was online harassment, and you know the image based harassment, and the type you know that so a lot moved online. We were particularly worried about younger people and the online world and the way that had taken off. So in some ways, if you close down one area, which you know we closed down the nighttime economy, so it was a bit of an experiment on that. But it's almost that sexual violence moves elsewhere and finds another outlet.
Dr. Cliona Sadley, our Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. An analysis conducted by the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland indicates 21,000 people, that's about the population of Selbridge and Maynooth maybe together, have been waiting over a year for surgery. That's 145% increase on pre-pandemic levels. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Stephen McMahon, co-founder and spokesperson of the Irish Patients Association. Stephen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
It would be very easy just to consider that data as precisely that, as numbers, 21,000 increase of 145%. But each and every one of those is a person waiting for surgery, either to improve their quality of life or rid them of an illness.
Absolutely. And that is a very important point to make, that, you know, because the figures are so high at the moment, people think of just the large number and they don't realise that each one of those is a patient. Each one of those perhaps has a family that have been concerned about that patient. And particularly with an elderly patient that may be waiting for, say, a hip replacement or some other sort of surgery that is going to actually improve the quality of life as a result of that. And, you know, like the report there, we're not surprised by that at all, because our own statistics, just looking at them, Ciara, on a national level. If we just look at Naas Hospital, actually, I had a quick look at that just before I came on air for you. And outpatient appointments, which are, you know, their first appointment to see a consultant or a consultant-led appointment. On the day before COVID in Naas Hospital, they had something in the region of about 8,219 people waiting to be seen. And of that, 2,200 were waiting more than 12 months. As of the end of August this year, the total number waiting for that consultant appointment has now risen to 11,281, or an increase of 37%. And those waiting more than 12 months, there are 4,700 people waiting now more than 12 months, which is an increase of, would you believe it, 113%. Now, for many of those patients waiting to see the consultant, that may be, that visit may be all that's needed. You know, their GP has referred them, they're waiting for tests or whatever, and they're, you know, they're put at ease about the particular condition that they have. But because the numbers are so large, there are percentages of those that will actually need ongoing care and perhaps, you know, more surgery. And as I said to you, the surgery waiting list numbers themselves are increasing. While in overall terms, you might say in, say, Naas Hospital, the numbers might be relatively low, the trend overall is upwards. I mean, if we look on a national level, which includes children here now, and the increases for elective surgeries, which are the, I think, 27 odd surgical classifications, it went up by 6% to 75,000 and went up by almost 90% to 20,284, which is the population of the townland that you were talking about, waiting more than 12 months for an operation.
I often think as well, when we use the phrase elective surgery, that people kind of think, oh, look, you're choosing to have this, so therefore it's grand if you don't have it. It is not grand, because in many ways, in knee or hip replacements or surgeries of that ilk are tagged as elective surgeries. And if you're walking around or trying to walk and you need a new knee, you need a new hip, it does not feel like a choice.
Absolutely. And it's a very, very important point to make, Ciara, that, you know, as I say, there are some 33 waiting lists for different types of surgeries, for cardiology, for general surgery, for gynecology, you know, for orthopedics. And they would be the ones that there would be large numbers waiting on. And I think that, you know, in a way, sometimes I feel when I go on the airwaves that, you know, for people with private health insurance, they sort of say, sort of, thank God I'm not a public patient. But, you know, the reality is that for public patients, that about one out of every three of them nationally, for those that are not insured, are on some waiting list or other. And we compare that then to private patients who have relatively negligible waiting lists, even if they do have to wait for their surgery. And what happens there is the GP refers them. They say that they have private health insurance or that they're going to pay privately, and they're referred to a consultant and they're asked what day is suitable. You know, they might be given options, which might be in the next week or two or maybe sooner. And they're then given, you know, yes, I think you need to have this operation, and you're given a date for that appointment, which is probably within the next few weeks or whatever. And that, to the private patient, is not an elective surgery. It's a surgery that's required, clinically decided for them. And it's the same exactly for the public patient. So it's so important for people to realize this is not an elective issue where somebody may be going for, you know, and I don't want to identify, but let's say, you know, just cosmetic surgery because there's some aspect that they, you know, they want to have improved or whatever.
And but there would be a different kind of need for that, but it certainly may not be clinical.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. And again, that's another subject in its own right. But
Absolutely. The
point I'm trying to make is that it's not something that you can and cannot do. For example, like, you know, we sent in a submission to the All-Party Oireachtas Committee on Health there yesterday or the day before. And while it was a wide-ranging concern about what has happened to Sláintecare, and Sláintecare is a solution down the road, but it is down the road. And the very things that the people who resigned from Sláintecare, Laura McGahey and Professor Keane, you know, it was over a lack of progress on a number of particular areas. And they were, you know, waiting lists, which we're talking about now, the e-information, you know, electronic information systems, and the regionalisation of hospitals and the building of elective-only hospitals. And now we hear that the elective-only hospitals, and we have to have this clarified, are going to be built to deal with day cases. That's not looking at these cases where it's inpatient care that's that we're actually looking at. So, you know, I had a patient on just 2 days ago or 3 days ago, and he clarified further this morning that he was waiting 2 years to be told at one hospital that he was okay. Then he went after that and got an MRI, which showed that he'd been complaining about this pain now for a number of years, and he had an MRI scan in March of 2021 and was diagnosed with a torn L1 disc impinging on an S1 root nerve, disc protrusion on T6, T7, T10 to 11, and finally disc bulges on C4, 5 and 6. Now, that was the state of this gentleman. Went back to his GP and was referred to a consultant in another hospital and was told this week that it would be 4 years before he would be seen.
So that now, man will have been living in pain for a minimum of 7 or 8 years.
Been living in pain for years. Exactly, Ciara. Now, the thing is that gentleman is, you know, not alone. You have many others. Like, I remember a case probably a year or so ago where an elderly lady had a prolapsed womb and needed gynecological surgery. And she was waiting so long that she got depressed. She got withdrawn from her grandchildren. She didn't go to mass and things like that. And because she had waited so long. And then she finally had an accident in her bathroom where she slipped and fell and ended back up in the hospital again. The op wasn't done. And finally, after some further length of time, that the operation was done. Within a short period of time, that elderly lady was able to go and meet her grandchildren, go out and do her shopping and meet her pals down in the local supermarkets and outside the church and so on. And her life was restored. So these operations are absolutely critical. And as an advocacy body, we're saying, yes, we welcome the plans down the road, but what are we going to do about the patients today that need this care? And it's been going on for years. It's not just this government's got the problem. It's been going on for years and years and years, and it just has to stop.
Well, Stephen McMahon, co-founder and spokesperson of the Irish Patients Association, thank you indeed for joining us. The Kildare Volunteer Awards 2021 have been opened, and to tell us all about it, joined on the line by Mick Power of the Kildare Volunteer Centre. Mick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. Yes, we're delighted to be holding our first full volunteer awards this year, so we are. And it's because of the huge response that we had from people last year during COVID, particularly last year, and some of the months of this year as well. But we'd over 1,200 people came to us last year.
Oh, wow.
And we registered to volunteer. And there was such a sense of goodwill of wanting to help out, wanting to help people who couldn't help themselves and things such as that. So that's why we've got volunteer awards this year, so we have.
Now, you need people to nominate those absolutely stellar volunteers who are literally in every nook and cranny of County Kildare, so that you, Mick, in the Kildare Volunteer Centre, know all about them and will be able to make the very difficult decision about who to give an award to or not. So you'll accept nominations from sport, from community groups, from what kinds of volunteer organisations?
Any type of volunteer organisations. We've two awards. One of them is for a group that was had for volunteers involved in some of the work that they did. So some of the great work done there was people doing meals on wheels and stuff like that, and people such as the Red Cross and that. But if you look at people that were individuals that weren't even formally volunteering, that were dropping shopping and prescription to people inside their homes who couldn't get out. So there's a huge range of people that are that we just want to thank.
I would say, Mick, that in a lot of instances, like those kinds of people you just mentioned there, people that lended a hand because a hand was needed, wouldn't even consider themselves volunteers, and but may not recognise the huge value of the contribution they've made.
Oh, yes. I mean, say, there was no way an organisation such as us could help to arrange for those deliveries to happen. And it was people in their own communities who knew where people lived, who were quickly able to identify where people needed a handout. And people couldn't have survived without that. So it was an amazing outgoing of goodwill towards people. And this has been recognised by our the Department of Rural and Community Affairs, who are actually supporting the awards.
And Mick, how can people nominate those absolutely stellar volunteers?
Right. If they go to our website, they will see that there's a form, that there's a piece that will guide them to where there's a form, and they can do it on the line as such. And then we will shortlist them, and then we will have a judging panel that will make a decision on that.
Now, the deadline isn't all that far away. It's the 5th of November. It's just That's under right. 4 weeks. And tell me, how in the name of God, Mick, are you going to have to be able to decide who gets these awards? You're not doing that all by yourself.
No. We're not. We have staff here and we've got a board of management, and that they will look at that. And we will draw up a short list of volunteers and give it to a judging panel that will have external people. It's not ourselves. There'll be our chairman and two more people who will make the final decision, Ciara.
And there will be a ceremony this year. It's going to be in Áras Kildare towards the end of November.
That's right, yes. And on top of that, we've got a couple of special awards, so we have. We have to recognise the volunteers that played a huge role in the various testing centres that were in the county throughout the year. And also with somebody who sent stories into various nursing homes during the very dark and difficult days, and those stories they were called Stories of Old, and that they were read out and people discussed them, and it gave them some focus to take their mind off things during those awful days when all the deaths and everything else were happening in nursing homes.
Well, Mick Power of the Kildare Volunteer Centre, thank you indeed for joining us. And as Mick said, that deadline very fast approaching. The closing date for nominations for the Kildare Volunteer Award is 5 o'clock on Friday, November 5th. You can find out more information on volunteerkildare.ie.